DW Deutsche Welle. World Link.
Welcome to DW's World Link, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. In Bonn, Germany, I'm Gabriel Borud. On this week's program, we're going to take an in-depth look at a recent crackdown on the gay community in Egypt.
This is probably one of the most severe crackdowns on LGBT people in modern Egyptian history.
We're going to find out what the hysteria is all about, and we'll also hear personally from someone in Cairo about what it's like to live as a gay man in Egypt. But that is not all this week. We're also going to find out from the ground in Israel what women have to say about peace in the Middle East. It'll all make sense if you stay with me on this edition of WorldLink. You're listening to DW's World Link with me, Gabriel Borud. We're going to start the show in Berlin, although actually the topic is Egypt. There was a small demonstration this week in the German capital, a group of people showing solidarity for dozens of Egyptians, thousands of miles away, who've been put in jail for their sexuality over the past 3 weeks. As small as Wednesday's gathering was, there were no more than 30 people present, it was one sign in Germany that people here are concerned about the situation in Cairo. It was organized by a guy named Lael Zara Mortada.
As a queer person myself, and as someone who comes from an Arab-speaking country and who spent time in Egypt, when I heard about what's happening, the first thing that comes to mind is that the Egyptian police is extremely violent. This is something that I was firsthand witness during the revolution of human rights activists who got arrested. Thinking about it now and hearing the news, I thought of the normal violence that is happening, or the normalized violence that is happening, and that is would be increased because of homophobia and transphobia that is fed to the police. So this is why we wanted to move, me and everybody who was part of the informal group that got formed in Berlin. We wanted to get together as soon as possible to demand action in an urgent way, because we know every minute that is being spent in police custody is another threat to the safety and to the dignity of these people. It is heartbreaking. It's terrifying. I know especially that from the LGBTIQ Egyptians that are in Berlin, they're afraid to speak up, and this is why non-Egyptians are taking the forefront in the media, because the Egyptian embassy here in Berlin always sends informers to such events, and then they notify the authorities, and when these people go back to Egypt, then they would suffer, by arrests at the airport or defamation campaigns against them and against their families.
The crackdown in Egypt happened in the wake of this concert that we're hearing right now by a band called Mashrua Layla on Friday, September 22nd in Cairo. The band is actually Lebanese, but at that concert, a couple of fans waved rainbow gay pride flags because members of the band, notably the lead singer, are gay. Pictures of the flags being waved were spread on social media, and a backlash on conservative Egyptian media condemning, quote, public support of homosexuality moved authorities to arrest those responsible. In a bid to prove their wrongdoing, authorities have performed anal examinations on some of those in custody. Senior researcher Nila Ghoshal at Human Rights Watch, who focuses on LGBTQ rights, told me from Beirut in Lebanon via Skype that she's never seen anything like it.
This is probably one of the most severe crackdowns on LGBT people in modern Egyptian history. We've had reports of at least 44, but possibly as many as 59 people who've been arrested since September 22nd, when some young people waved rainbow flags at a concert. The government essentially jumped into immediate action and started rounding people up. People who looked gay on the streets of Cairo, going to neighborhoods that are known for having gay hangout spots. But this has been happening at really quite unprecedented rates. We've seen large numbers of arrests of suspected LGBT people for the last 4 years in Egypt, ever since the coup in 2013 that eventually brought President al-Sisi into power. And so we do know that in the last 4 years, more than 300 people have been arrested. But 50 in a period of less than 3 weeks is really quite shocking.
Speaking of the random, or the seemingly random way in which the authorities have apprehended people, what's the legal basis for them doing this?
Well, there are several laws that they are using. There are laws in Egypt that outlaw debauchery and incitement to debauchery. And these terms are not defined at all.
The oppression of the LGBT community is not unique to Egypt. Although the country has no law that explicitly criminalizes homosexuality, police there can charge suspects with debauchery and inciting sexual deviancy under an anti-prostitution law enacted in 1961. Homosexual acts are illegal in more than 70 countries, however, most of them in Africa and the Middle East. Being openly gay in these states can result in severe punishment, or in some cases, even death. Many of the countries with these laws in North Africa, the Middle East or Asia have Muslim majority populations. In some African countries, the legislation dates back to colonial times and has never been repealed. In 123 countries, same-sex consensual acts have been decriminalized or never penalized. And then there are countries that do not specifically outlaw homosexuality, but where members of the LGBT community are routinely targeted under loosely worded laws against public indecency, pornography, or debauchery. This is the case in Egypt.
As far as we and our many partner organizations in the region have documented, Egypt seems to be by far the worst offender. There are other countries that have gotten, you know, really bad press and sometimes merited for their crackdowns on LGBT people. Uganda comes to mind as a country that's always in the news. But in Uganda, nobody has actually ever been convicted for consensual same-sex conduct.
What is the problem with homosexuality in Egypt?
To be honest, from talking to a number of friends from LGBT communities in Egypt, they have been feeling that the general population has been making a lot of progress in terms of their understanding of homosexuality, their willingness to consider the issues, to have healthy debates about them, to take the first steps toward accepting people. And I think that is something that governments and religious leaders find threatening. So when you start to see progress, you often find that there's a swift effort to crack down on it. And so that's one of the things that's happening here.
In my research for this program, I found an Egyptian here who is gay, who is a refugee. And he told me his story. And then I asked him for an interview. And he said, no, absolutely no way. Not even for radio if I kept his name anonymous.
Yes. People in Egypt are really afraid right now. People are afraid that they could be arrested by association with someone else. So I imagine that this man that you spoke with may feel that if he speaks out and if he's somehow identified, that could potentially put his friends, his family members in Egypt at risk. It would not be unprecedented for the Egyptian authorities to go after people simply because they are associated with someone who is suspected of being gay. So there's absolutely an atmosphere of fear. A lot of people have gone underground. People have fled their homes. When you start arresting, you know, 50, 100 people, you really send a signal that anybody could be targeted at any moment. And no one knows when this crackdown is going to end. And of course, once you've been outed, once you've been suspected of being gay, you are essentially, in the eyes of the Egyptian authorities, a criminal.
That man here in Germany would not talk to me in the end, but I did find somebody in Cairo who was willing to share with me what it's like for him to live as a gay man there. He asked me not to say his name, and he sent a statement via email so that his voice would not be on the air, because if the authorities in Egypt heard his statement, he would likely be arrested too. I'm going to read his statement now, so please bear with me. I am a 32-year-old gay man living in Egypt. Hiding my sexuality has been the epicenter of my adult life. Even though I am an outspoken defender of LGBTQ rights, and my career is dedicated to gender and sexuality education, I never came out publicly for the fear of a multi-layered persecution system targeting homosexuals. Acting straight is the hegemonic decorum of gays and lesbians in Egypt. As an activist and a proponent of the concept, personal is political. It hasn't been easy or comfortable leaving my identity in the shadows while speaking out for my LGBTQ community. 3 years ago, I was kidnapped, terrorized, and humiliated for a whole night because I trusted a group of people with my secret. And although I got out of the situation safely with the help of a friend, the emotional scarring still lives with me, and I had to undergo an intensive therapy course only to be able to leave my house and look for jobs once again. Whenever I meet someone new through gay circles or apps online, I have to struggle with anxiety for the fear they might be an undercover police agent on a manhunt. I hated myself as I grew up. Internalized homophobia was my best friend, and even after I started accepting myself, I attempted aversion therapy, which is sadly a huge scam business in Egypt. I did ultimately make my moral peace with being gay, and yet I felt it would be best for me if I managed to stop being it. However, I was lucky to meet my partner a week before my first session, and I never went. That was 8 years ago. I am not out to my family, and I'm not planning to do that anytime soon. I already feel guilty for entertaining the thought, as the effects of such a statement could be detrimental to my mother's health. I did not go to the Mashrua Leila concert. Many of my friends, including my partner, went though. They spoke about tapping into a sense of freedom they had not known could exist. The rainbow flag waver, who is in custody as we speak, is a personal acquaintance and a colleague in feminist and LGBTQ activism. The ongoing news of the arrests is filling me with anger and fear, and is casting a dark shadow on the future of the Egyptian rights and freedom system. Earlier this year, I decided to leave Egypt and apply for asylum, but 1 month through the process, I became overwhelmed emotionally, and I withdrew my application. The complexity of the process, along with a bad episode of homesickness, pushed me towards returning home to a dark, but at least familiar fate. At this point, I honestly don't have any faith in the Egyptian regime to change its homophobic agenda. Facing massive criticism and losing popularity, the crackdown is giving Sisi's government leverage in a tight political and economic situation. Homophobia sells, and while atrocities like unlawful detentions, forced disappearances, and military trials for civilians are committed by the government daily, the madding crowd is cheering for the gay arrests. And that was a statement sent to me by a gay man in Egypt who asked to remain anonymous for fear of persecution. I am joined now in the studio by Hassan, who is a 40-year-old freelance journalist from Egypt. Hassan, you've been here in Germany for 4 months now. Can you understand the fears that we've just heard expressed?
Yes, I can exactly understand these kind of fears. It's black and white in Egypt. If you are a man, then you have a woman as a wife. And if you're a woman, then you have a man as a husband. That's it. The society cannot accept the idea of having different people with different sexualities.
And that goes throughout society, the religious leaders, the political leaders, the people on the street. I mean, what is the big problem with homosexuality in Egypt?
It's mixed between customs and traditions and beliefs in the society and the Egyptian society and the Arab society, and it's all also about Islam, which is vital, like water and air inside the people in the Arab world, and in Islam, being an LGBT person is not acceptable. By all means, and even
It says that in the Quran, homosexuality is not accepted.
It's not that clear. It's not that clear. But there was a story about a prophet who is receiving kind of visitors who are men.
That was the village of Sodom.
the village of Sodom, and the Quran mentioned that this village was destroyed by God because of their bad actions. And it's all also here about bad actions. There was no clear mention in Quran that these actions were taken by God because of these people were having sex with same sex. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay, so let's fast forward then 1400 years. You're Egyptian.
Yes.
What do you think about homosexuality?
Well, I think it's not of my business. Everyone has the right to do whatever he wants. I'm not the messenger of God. Even if you believe that I am the person who is Muslim, is not on the right way. This is your right. I cannot discuss this with you because of your right as a human. You have the right to do it.
So you think it's okay?
For me, it's okay.
And that makes you very different than your average Egyptian. And
it's also, I'm afraid.
It's also illegal what you
yes,
just said.
Exactly.
If you said what you just said in Cairo, could you be put in jail?
Yeah. You cannot say this in Egypt.
How does that make you feel?
Like millions of Egyptians who cannot express their thoughts and idea in an open discussion. You have lots of things to hide inside you. So it's like a fire inside you that you are trying to hold it inside, because if it's out, you will go to the jail.
Many thanks to Hassan speaking to me here in the studios of Deutsche Welle in Bonn, Germany. Thank you very much for listening to this look at the situation in Egypt. I sincerely hope you've been informed by the perspectives. You are listening to World Link on Deutsche Welle. Israeli and Palestinian women are waging peace, campaigning together to end the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and put peace back on the top of the political agenda. A rally of 30,000 women in Jerusalem this week followed a number of gatherings across Israel. But can they channel this energy to return their leaders to the negotiating table? Iris Makler reports from the Dead Sea.
The Mothers, the anthem of the Women Wage Peace Movement, blares out in a park in Jaffa, part of the seaside city of Tel Aviv. Thousands of women listen and dance in the autumn sunshine. The performers, like the audience, are Israeli and Arab women seeking to channel female energy to bring an end to this conflict.
We have like 27,000 members. 20% Arab Israelis, and 20% men. We are speaking about an inclusive feminism.
The group was formed after the Gaza War of 2014 by Israeli mothers, including Lily Weisberger.
It's time for healing. That's the reason that after 4,000 years, we are saying enough is enough. It's time for peace, for reconciliation. It's time to create a new story and not repeat again and again this tragedy. Thousands of Palestinian sisters are going to join us, and together we are creating this awakening of hope.
This message appealed to French migrant Pascal Chen, as her teenage son received his call-up to do Israeli military service during the Gaza War.
This is my responsibility to do something as a citizen, as a mother. After the war, I realized that it's about time. I should do something. I should stop watching TV and crying in front of the screen.
The women marched through Jaffa to get their message out, singing, dancing, and playing drums, guitars, and flutes. They've been holding events like this across the country this autumn, hoping to expand their base and to unite all women, Palestinian and Israeli, old and young, Muslim, Christian and Jewish, and also left and right within Israeli society. Pascal Shen says this is one of their biggest challenges.
Women Wage Peace is a political movement, but it is not affiliated to any party. And in order to succeed, in order to influence our government, we have to be as many as possible. And this is not a question of right and left, because peace is for everybody, like security.
Shen says she believes that today's march has attracted new women. But for Palestinian women, it's different. They can't just come from the West Bank to join in. The only place Israelis and Palestinians can meet without permits is in a part of the West Bank known as Area C. So that's where Women Wage Peace organised its main rally this week. Lama Abu Arkoub, a mother of five from Hebron, is one of 3,000 Palestinian women boarding buses across the West Bank early Sunday.
The message is enough with violence, enough with hatred, enough with blood, enough with war.
They reach a stretch of desert near the Dead Sea where two huge tents have been erected, named for Hajar and Sarah, the biblical mothers of the Muslim and Jewish peoples. But Lama Abu Arkoub concedes many of the Palestinian women had to battle to get here.
Yeah, in my community, I cannot go telling everybody that I'm participating in this. Most people think that if we are doing this, we are beautifying the image of occupation in Palestine, and that's a crime. So you cannot go tell everybody.
Some 10,000 Palestinian and Israeli women walk together through the desert, looking very much like a scene from the Bible or the Quran themselves. They say it's a wonderful feeling to mingle freely, for a moment no longer enemies, and filled with hope. Lama Abu Arkoub again.
Oh, I am very optimistic, and I know it will make a difference. It will take time, yes, it will take more effort and a bigger number of women participating next time to send a stronger voice, but I am optimistic, and I know that this will lead to something, because women are strong, and women can, and they will.
They shelter from the sun inside the tent after their hot, dusty walk, meeting up with old friends and making new ones. Critics say this is idealistic, not realistic. But Women Wage Peace believe that soft power can lead to real results, to benefit both peoples. Next stop, Israel's parliament, to start lobbying politicians. Iris Makler, DW, at the Dead Sea.
Please stay tuned to WorldLink with me, Gabriel Borud, coming to you from DW in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to DW's World Link with me, Gabriel Borud. Coming up in the second half of the program, we'll meet an 89-year-old activist documenting farmer suicides in northern India, and the South African surrogacy pioneer helping childless couples start a family.
I was pregnant 4 years in a row. So in January, the second year, in February, the year after that, in June, the year after that, in August.
Plus, the Chilean doctor with a unique approach to healthcare. All that and more coming up on WorldLink. From the very first day he announced that he was running for president of the United States of America, to his repeated calls for a wall along the Mexican border, Donald Trump has been very clear about his goal to limit migration to the U.S. He's announced legislation that would cut legal immigration by more than 600,000 in a year. And just last week, he released a list of proposals he wants enacted, including securing funding for his border wall, cracking down on unaccompanied immigrant minors, and overhauling the asylum system. So how is Trump's stance impacting asylum seekers? Lena Nzizwa sat down with an immigration attorney in Los Angeles to find out.
Hola, buenos días. Pregunta para asilo.
In his homeland of Guatemala, he was a police officer. But on this day, he's a refugee seeking asylum because of the violence in his birthplace at the San Ysidro Port of Entry near San Diego, along the border between Mexico and California. He was rejected the first time he tried to seek asylum. That's why during this second attempt, he's secretly recording his encounter with a cell phone hidden in his shirt pocket. And again, he is turned away by a private security guard contracted by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security.
And for years, we really didn't, you would hear of people being turned away, but it wasn't like almost uniform.
Immigration attorney Nora Phillips says seeing what she describes as a significant pattern of rejection of asylum seekers prompted her to be at the forefront of bringing a class action lawsuit against officials with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and Customs and Border Protection. The cell phone video is just one example of what Phillips describes as a systematic violation of U.S. and international law.
If an individual presents themselves at a port of entry stating that they have a fear of return because they're going to be persecuted, it says the officer shall, not may, shall refer that individual for processing for a credible fear interview. That does not mean they're going to win their case, but they need to at least be able to access that legal remedy.
She says asylum seekers trying to gain entry into the United States have been greeted with a variety of responses. Some, as in the case of the former policeman from Guatemala, are referred back to Mexico for U.S. asylum. Phillips says others have been told if they seek asylum, their children will be taken away. And she says still others have been blocked at the border with the excuse that Donald Trump has done away with asylum in the U.S. According to a transcript published by the Washington Post, during a conversation this January between the President of the United States and Australia's Prime Minister, Donald Trump expressed his distaste for asylum seekers. The transcript records Trump as saying, quote, "I'm the world's greatest person that does not want to let people into the country." Phillips says the truth is asylum seekers, many of whom are women, are escaping from unimaginable cruelty.
Exhausted pregnant women with little kids running from just unspeakable abuse. Rape, domestic violence, being hunted from one country to the other, and then being placed in just massive danger because they keep trying and trying and trying to turn themselves in. Women who've already been, had their souls crushed, walking across several countries.
Phillips says during the Obama administration, immigration attorneys also were faced with what she describes as horrible things.
The Trump administration is taking things to an even higher level of human cruelty and violations of due process and unconstitutional executive orders.
In a statement released by the Department of Homeland Security just before the lawsuit was filed, the CBP said that no policies have changed regarding asylum procedures. Phillips is the co-founder and legal director of Al Otro Lado, the nonprofit that helps migrants in both Los Angeles, California, and Tijuana, Mexico. She says their legal services have never been so urgently needed.
There have been a lot of stories recently of immigration attorneys that just since the election have quit. While I never will, I completely understand where they're coming from. It's absolutely soul-crushing.
Phillips' own ancestry is English and Irish. Also mixed in is more than a dash of feistiness. She brings cheer to her Los Angeles office with a colorful banner she has quilted together. Colorful patches of fabric spell out her organization's name, Al Otro Lado, which means to the other side in Spanish. In spite of weariness and widening legal boundaries, both Phillips and her clients are not giving up in their quest to get to the other side.
If you want to wait, yeah.
Lenin Ozizwe, DW, Los Angeles.
And now to northern India, where the fertile state of Punjab, often called the country's breadbasket, for years it has prospered, supplying India with bountiful yields of wheat and rice. But there's a dark side to this success story. One local activist says farmers in the region are dying, and he has the documentation to back it up. Gairi Vaidyanathan has the story.
On a humid September afternoon, Inderjeet Singh Jaiji pulls up to a farmhouse in a small village in North India. He walks into the yard. A cow and her calf are sheltering under a tree. A drab, three-room house anchors one end of the yard. He greets the family. There is the mother. Her name is
Amarjeet Kaur.
She has two kids, Gagandeep Kaur, who's 17 and studying
BA first year,
and 13-year-old Hardeep Singh, who, Jaiji says,
he says he's going to join the police.
Jaiji is holding a piece of paper. It is a list of suicides. This family is number 29. Jaiji reads out the details.
This is village Sangatpura. Nazar Singh committed suicide on 2nd June this year. He was an agriculturist. He had half an acre. And his debt is 4 lakhs. He committed suicide by taking poison. And he has 2 children.
The list has 46 names. It has all the farmers who've committed suicide in this area in 2017. Jaiji has been maintaining this list for the past 30 years. We're in Punjab, India's most productive agricultural state. The rice fields stretch into the horizon like a deep green sea. The plants are heavy with grain. Almost every year, it seems, Punjab's farmers manage to set new records for rice and wheat yields. Punjab is supposed to be India's farming success story. But behind that shine is Jaiji's inconvenient list. It suggests some farmers here are facing an economic crisis. He has recorded 2,400 cases of farmer suicides since 1988. That is from just 120 villages. There are 12,500 villages in total in Punjab. So how many suicides are there? Farm worker Najar Singh could not make ends meet, his wife says. His living expenses far exceeded his earnings from farming, so he took out a loan.
He needed around 70 to 80,000 rupees per year for cultivation. He took a loan from the bank of 2.5 lakhs, or 250,000 rupees, and borrowed 1.5 lakhs from local moneylenders.
The interest accumulated over the years, and he had no hope of repaying it. So, one afternoon this June, his wife says,
he went inside, locked the room, and took poison. We took him to the hospital, but he died on the way.
That evening, we go to Jaiji's ancestral home in the village. The sun is sinking and goat herds are going home. Jaiji is 89 years old.
He's wearing a black turban, which is a religious symbol of Sikhism. He has a flowing white beard. And there is one more thing to know about him. He comes from a prominent family in India. His sister was one of India's last royals, the Queen of Patiala. His nephew is now the Chief Minister of Punjab.
So we've been families for at least 300-400 years. And we have been in this area for about 200 years.
Jaiji cares so much about the villagers because for hundreds of years, they've been his family's tenants and have come to them with problems. About 30 years ago, villagers told Jaiji of a place where 9 people had committed suicide. He became worried and asked the health department to investigate.
But they couldn't find out the reasons. And they wrote in their report that the suicides are genuine suicide, but it is due to the habit of the farmers to quarrel amongst themselves. Now, that didn't quite gel. So I sent them another list of something like 30 suicides in 5 villages.
That's how it all started. The government claimed that there wasn't a major suicide problem.
Because Punjab is a prosperous state. Punjab is a role model of a farmer for the rest of the country. If the role model is dying, that means they're all dying there.
Jaiji began documenting the suicides himself. He set up a network in the villages to investigate.
We have got a team of workers over there who we given motorcycles to and given them their respective areas to cover.
As JG's list of suicides grew, he realized Punjab has a major problem. Villagers told him about bodies floating down a canal nearby.
There's a blockage where canal water is sent to 2 different sides. And bodies used to come over there. We reported it to the police, we reported it to everyone. Police didn't react, police had 0 suicides.
We are at a pavilion overlooking the canal at Kanari. The walls of the pavilion are plastered with notices of missing persons.
These are the people. The relatives come and put their photographs over here, hoping that someone will tell them that their body has come here.
2 years ago, Jaiji brought news reporters here who saw the dead bodies. Kanari made the headlines. Jaiji wrote letters to the President of India, to the Human Rights Commission, to anyone who would listen. He published editorials in newspapers. The Punjab High Court finally ordered an investigation into farmer suicides in 2014. The investigators recently found that about 1,700 farmers in Punjab had killed themselves since 2000. Most of them were deep in debt. Jaiji has been helping the families for decades now. He's set up a non-profit that adopts families and educates the children of suicide victims.
So we adopt their families. And we tell them we'll give you 1,500 rupees if it's a larger family or small family, we'll give you 1,000 rupees. Put them in any school. They must study. The objective was empowerment through education.
The next morning, Jaiji walks through a narrow alleyway past 2 large black buffaloes. He arrives at a green door set in the wall. The room is dark. It has a rough cement floor and a bed at the center. 6 women slowly filter in. An old woman is holding a baby. This is the family of a suicide victim. Jaiji addresses a young woman. He finds out that she's dropped out of college because her family wants her married. He advises her mother to let her stay in school, and then he says goodbye. This girl, he senses, will not return to school.
Push them out, get them married and throw them out.
This is just the first visit, and he will do this all day today. I'm Gayatri Vaidyanathan in Punjab for DW.
Surrogacy can be fraught with ethical questions and difficult emotional decisions for everyone involved. The often highly controversial practice by which a woman carries a baby for someone else is banned in many European countries, while other countries, like South Africa, allow it, but only under very strict conditions. There, surrogates are not allowed to profit from the procedure, and they have to meet certain psychological and legal criteria to qualify. Our reporter Tony Andrews went to Johannesburg to meet Lee Ann Stridham, one of the women in charge of making sure the whole process runs smoothly.
That's Lee Ann Stridham. She's South Africa's first surrogacy facilitator. That basically means she matches surrogates with couples who want to have a baby. She also manages all the bureaucracy involved, which is a lot, but we'll get to that later. I'm here to get a sense of her daily routine. She starts by introducing me to one of the surrogates.
So she's a second-time surrogate. Louisa, how far are you pregnant now?
12 weeks.
Louisa is just one of many surrogates coming in and out of the clinic each day. It's quite a hyper-maternal place. The walls are lined with massive collages of hundreds of baby pictures.
All right.
Leanne sits down with some coffee and briefs me on what to expect for the day.
I've got a new set of intended parents coming in, and I need to take them through the whole process.
Soon, a couple in their mid-30s comes in looking a little nervous.
Okay, so maybe we should start off with you telling me a little bit more about you, your story, from when you guys met.
We've gone through 3 IVF cycles.
In order for the couple to legally be eligible to have a surrogate, the woman needs to have a, quote, permanent and irreversible condition preventing her from carrying a child to term. That is to say, she can't be doing it just because she wants to get out of gaining weight during pregnancy, for instance. Becoming a surrogate is also not simple. Each woman needs to meet strict criteria, which a judge eventually signs off on.
It's a very thorough screening process. That means we check for her mental capabilities, we check for her social life, you know, if her circumstances at home is good enough for her to be a surrogate, there should be no warning signs at all. We check for her emotional state with the psychologist.
A lawyer also gets involved to make sure that every aspect of the process complies with the Children's Act of 2010. Since then, a South African surrogate is not allowed to profit from the procedure. She has to hand in bank statements to prove she's not doing it for the money, for instance. She is allowed to receive a small stipend, though, an amount of money that Leanne calls an out-of-pocket expense.
An out-of-pocket expense is a certain amount that you get every month for maternity clothes, for special food, for someone to take care of your kids with appointments, everything except the medication and the fertility part.
They get about 390 euros a month. Leanne then goes on to explain how the relationship with the surrogate will be managed.
You must understand that she will not be your best friend. Obviously, you are going to have to set some boundaries.
One of the main rules is that for accountability, all communication takes place on a designated WhatsApp group. The people who receive messages in that group include Leanne, the surrogate and her partner, as well as both intended parents. All in all, the couple seems optimistic, but they're still a little cautious because they've heard some surrogate horror stories in the media.
They mentioned something about, you know, in the first 12 weeks.
Basically, their question is about, what happens if one party wants to terminate the pregnancy? Leanne's answer makes it clear just how messy this whole process can get.
The surrogate has the right to terminate forever. From the get-go, it's her body. The law says no one can force me to be pregnant, even though it's your baby. The law says I can terminate whenever I like to terminate. But the law also says if you want to terminate, and it's my body, I don't have to terminate, okay? If there is something wrong with this baby and you want to terminate, I can say no.
Leanne is quick to add that that kind of scenario is highly unlikely because the surrogate's mental health is checked and rechecked by so many people.
Either me, the lawyer, and the psychologist, and the doctor will pick up on stuff and start taking them apart. Why is this? Why is that?
It really is a process monitored by many gatekeepers. That's why it costs over 22,000 euros in total.
Okay, so what's step one then? Once after this discussion, do we meet with...
I have to speak to doctors.
But Leanne doesn't just deal with families beginning the journey. The 18 surrogacies that she's currently managing are at different phases. In the course of the day, she meets one surrogate who is already 6 weeks pregnant. She's accompanying her to her first internal scan, where the doctor will check how many babies are present. In each artificial insemination process, 2 viable embryos are inserted into the womb. So there's always the possibility that there could be twins.
Hi, how are you?
I wait just outside for a few minutes until they emerge with the results. And turns out, it's one baby.
See? And the only thing they can see at this stage is like a little bit of heartbeat, but it's very, very small.
Desiree Faree, the 37-year-old surrogate who was just scanned, says that seeing the heartbeat on the screen is still emotional for her, even though she's already had three of her own children. Every surrogate has to have had at least one of her own kids to qualify.
It was a wonderful feeling. Although it's not my child, it was still, wow. It's a miracle from God, so it stays a miracle. Yeah.
Desiree's husband is a successful attorney, so the financial assistance she gets through this process does not feature in the list of reasons why she's doing it.
I wanted to help people because I think every woman out there deserves that feeling to be a mom.
It's one of the questions she gets asked most often is how she's going to feel when she has to give the baby to the intended parents.
I'm not getting attached because I went into this whole thing knowing that's not my baby. So yeah, I'm going to give them back their baby.
That phrasing, to give the baby back as opposed to giving it up, is something she learned from Leanne, the facilitator you heard earlier. That's right, Leanne used to be a surrogate herself. Not once, not twice, but five times, including a set of twins, all delivered by cesarean section.
I was pregnant 4 years in a row. So in January, the second year, in February, the year after that, in June, the year after that, in August.
She'd had two of her own before she became a surrogate, which means she's had a total of eight children. Being pregnant that many times gave rise to some pretty hilarious scenarios, like this one scene Leanne describes in which she's chatting to strangers in a shop.
They would ask me, is this your first? And I would say, yes, because how do I explain it's my eighth, you know? And they would say, oh, well, congratulations. And then they would congratulate my husband as well. And he would say, well, it's not mine. And then they would look at me like, okay. And then I'll tell them it's not mine either. And I'll just turn around and walk away.
But the reason she puts all this passion into surrogacy has a somewhat darker origin story. Even now, she struggles to talk about it.
I actually come from a childhood of... No, do we have to do this?
As much as you feel comfortable with.
Okay, so I don't know where to start. Okay, so... So I was born in a small town called Sasselburg.
She tells me about the poverty she grew up in and the sexual abuse she experienced. She explains that she dropped out of school when she was 15 after she became pregnant. The next few years were tough on her and the baby.
So with no educational background or anything whatsoever, I had my daughter and I struggled to try and find out what life is about, you know, from here on.
When she became pregnant again a few years later, she decided to give that second child up for adoption.
I just knew that I didn't want to struggle. I didn't want to bring him into this world and let him struggle with me. It wasn't fair towards his sister and it wasn't fair towards him.
And so she gave him up, but something didn't quite feel right.
So I think I'm adoption's worst case scenario because something haunted me from the time that he was born for 3 weeks.
She couldn't shake that feeling. So eventually, she resolved to take her son back.
I remember I called the welfare worker and she said to me, Leanne, the only way you're going to go fetch him is if you take him off the mommy's breast. So she wasn't breastfeeding, but she was bonding with him skin to skin. So I had to go into the house where there was probably 100 family members there that couldn't believe that I was going to go fetch my son. And they were supporting the adoptive parents. And I walked into the house. I couldn't make any eye contact because obviously they were like very against me fetching him.
The family tried to give her accessories for the baby, but she refused to take them. She felt like she couldn't take any more than she already had.
I definitely understood the impact I did and my decision to turn it around. And as I went to take him and I put him into the car seat, on the front car seat, right next to the driver's seat where you're not allowed to put a baby,
I remember I said to him, you will never be sorry that I'm your mother. I promise you that from this stage, from this day, I'll make something out of my life.
This experience was obviously devastating for the adoptive parents as well as for Leanne. But it also goes a long way to explaining why she's so passionate about helping people have children today. She no longer is physically able to carry babies as a surrogate, but she says facilitation feels like a good compromise.
I'm very satisfied with the job that I do now. So even though I'm not pregnant now, I'm still able to be part of this process, but just in a different way.
It's unclear if she'll ever feel like she's atoned for the pain she caused that first adoptive family. In the meantime, what is clear is that she is helping a lot of people experience the gift of parenthood who otherwise would have no hope. For DW in Johannesburg, South Africa, I'm Tony Andrews.
In Chile's capital, Santiago, there's a medical center where MRI scanners are designed to look like rocket ships and doctors dress up in astronaut suits. This unique place is the creation of Dr. Patricio Mardones, whose plans to revolutionize healthcare in his country have led some to call him Chile's Patch Adams. Visits to public hospitals in Chile can often involve long waiting lists and impersonal service. Only around 1 in 5 people can afford the alternative, expensive private healthcare. But Mardones says his medical center shows it doesn't have to be that way. Jane Chambers has the story.
When banks refused to loan Dr. Mardones the money he needed for his project, he and his friends raised $3 million to build this state-of-the-art health center. It's in a poor area of Santiago, and the brightly coloured orange, red and yellow windows stand out from the grey streets around here. Mardones has worked in the public health system for the last 20 years, and now he wants to change things. I'm just off to meet him, and I want to know what inspires him.
A mí me emocionó mucho, fundamentalmente, cuando tomé el metro, y una señora adulta mayor, viejita.
Something that really changed how I thought about medicine happened when I was a student. I got on the metro with a heavy bag full of books, and an old lady stood up and offered me her seat. When I refused, she insisted I take it, saying, "When you qualify to be a doctor, you will look after me, so I need to look after you." And after that, I thought I really need to do something to change our healthcare system in Chile. These days, instead of calling someone a patient, they call them a client. Patients are not clients. They should always be treated as patients and cared for. We need to bring down our prices and think about the people we are helping. And then we will be doing another type of medicine.
Y privado va a entender que existe otra forma de hacer medicina.
Everything about this hospital is focused on making the patients feel at ease, especially the children who are often the ones who come here for what can be a very scary experience, a scan. So I'm in the waiting room and we've got a few children here. There are little tables with lots of toys for them to play with and there are brightly coloured fish on the walls. It's a very, very colourful, cosy atmosphere. And the whole point of this, as the doctors have just been explaining to me, is to make them feel at ease. It's their parents are going to be stressed in this kind of situation, worried about their children, worried about how they're going to deal with the scan. So they want this area to be as cosy and relaxing as possible. And then they go through these doors into the actual hospital space.
What is the celeste? Ese. Colocamos la sala celeste. Ya, mira.
What I've just seen was absolutely brilliant. We have Patricio with a little boy. He was so excited. He told him he was going on a journey into space. And he came and he chose the blue alien and the room's been all blue. And they looked at the wall and they saw various people with masks on because they've got their space masks on. And then Patricio said, well, you can have one too. And he's gone into the MRI scan.
Le dimos una historia a su examen. El niño no viene a hacerse un examen de MRI.
We tell the children a story that they are going on a journey into space. The room has pictures of rockets and spacemen on the wall, and the actual scanner is designed to look like a rocket. I'm dressed in an orange spacesuit. It's all about changing the language we use and the way we treat the situation. They're not coming to do a test, they are having an exciting adventure. The child has their mother beside them. This little boy, who is only six, has a genetic disorder that causes tumors to form in the nerve tissue. I was told that this boy was really stressed out about having the scan because he has had bad experiences before. But you saw him, he was excited and happy, and his mother was relaxed, which is also very important. By treating it as a game, we could do the test.
Estamos hablando de un niño que tiene capacidad y solamente jugando le hicimos el procedimiento o el examen.
The majority of patients who come to the center are children. The next one is a five-month-old baby girl, and I'm just about to go and speak to her parents, who are waiting anxiously in reception.
Tenemos nuestra chiquitita cinco meses, con una observación rara en la cadera derecha en el huesito.
Our little girl is 5 months old, and we are worried about the bone on her right hip. We think it might be a tumor, and she could have cancer, so we're here to do a scan. My cousin is a doctor, and she recommended we come here. It was great we got an appointment straight away.
You're the mother, sitting here looking a bit nervous, but what's the experience been like?
It's great here. Everyone is so kind. The doctor explains everything and makes us feel less nervous.
What would you say then are the problems with healthcare here in Chile?
Aquí, mientras no se divida lo público con lo privado y no se dé el foco más al público.
The private and public healthcare systems have such different standards. One is far too expensive, and the other is bad quality with waiting lists that are far too long. They need to combine the two and subsidize healthcare so that everyone has access to good quality, affordable care.
The parents are very relieved to hear that their little girl's fine and there's no sign of cancer. And Dr. Mardones tells me he wants to help many more people with centres like his all over Chile. It's a long, thin country where people are often forced to travel for hundreds of kilometres to get an important scan done. His centre is open to patients with both private and public healthcare insurance, and they're all charged the same price, around four times less than what other private clinics charge. And certainly after speaking to parents and other doctors at different hospitals, it's an idea that many people think could improve healthcare in Chile. Jane Chambers, DW, Santiago, Chile.
And that wraps up this week's edition of WorldLink. We hope you enjoyed it, and we'll tune in again next week. And if you can't wait until then, you'll find all our episodes at dw.com/WorldLink, on SoundCloud, under DW English, or on iTunes. You can also connect with us on Facebook by visiting our page DW Global Society. Or you can drop us a line via email at worldlinkdw.com. WorldLink was produced by Natalie Muller and me, Gabriel Borud. Our sound engineer was Christoph Groove. WorldLink was brought to you by DW in Bonn, Germany. بلا فلوس وبلا بيت